Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert by CBS, according to some observers, says a lot about the future of television. According to CBS, the cancellation was a financial decision. Some see it as Paramount, CBS's parent company, bowing to pressure from the Trump administration. Others see it as further proof that late-night talk shows could be saying goodnight. Here's what Stephen Colbert had to say.
You may have heard the news. Last week, we learned that The Late Show will be ending in May. And now, for the next 10 months, the gloves are off. I can finally... Yeah. I can finally speak unvarnished truth to power and say what I really think about Donald Trump, starting right now. I don't care for him. Doesn't seem to have, like, the skill set. Doesn't have the skill set to be president. You know, just not a good fit. That's all.
We're talking about the changing television landscape this hour. And joining us now is Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV with Variety Magazine. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks so much.
So let's start with the cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. There's a lot of different theories about why this is happening right now and what it means. What's your take?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all of the above, all of the things that you mentioned earlier. There's a little bit of truth to the fact that the late night landscape is definitely challenged. Ratings are down. Ad revenue is down. These shows that once were printing money for the networks are now losing money. But there is also still an element of a sense that it didn't hurt when it came time for Paramount Global to finish its deal to be acquired by Skydance Media, that there have already been a number of other capitulations to this administration, including settling the lawsuit with the Trump administration over 60 Minutes for over $32 million, it sounds like. And there have been other instances of this company looking to get that deal done and bending a little bit at the knee to this government. And there's a sense that this was definitely a signal that Paramount wanted to send to the government that they're willing to play ball with this administration.
What do you think this means to other late night shows? Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, Seth Meyers, should they be worried?
I do think that we're seeing sort of the end of an era of these shows. I think they'll stick around for a while longer. They're still doing decently. They're still pulling in some cases, 2 million viewers a night. And that's not even including where most people watch these shows now, which is on YouTube. Most people are watching these shows on clips, and the networks are able to monetize that as well. But in the long term, when Jimmy Kimmel decides to finally end his show, I don't think there'll be a replacement. There's not going to be someone taking over that late night slot on ABC. Same with Seth Meyers. The one show that may continue just because of tradition is The Tonight Show, show that's been on the air for 70 years, and I'd have a hard time seeing NBC giving up that franchise. But nonetheless, we may be back to a world with maybe one late night show, like most of the 60s and 70s when Johnny Carson was the only game in town. We're kind of heading back to that era.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm one of those clip watchers for traditional late night. I watch clips on Instagram. I never stay up till 11:30 to watch anymore. I mean, does anyone? You mentioned 2 million people, so some do.
Yeah, so it's new. I think a lot of those folks probably record the show or watch it maybe in other time slots. Maybe they're watching the show on Hulu or Paramount Plus or other forms as well. I don't think there are many people that are actually watching live at 11:35 anymore the way they used to. Because you're right, it's all about the clips now. It's all about the YouTube hits.
Now, what would you say are some of the biggest changes in how we watch television compared to 10 to 20 years ago? Is it all streaming and on demand, or social media is now playing a role in this too, in these changes?
It's all of it. I think the biggest stat is the fact that YouTube is now by far the most watched platform, beating out even Netflix, beating out some of the other streaming services as well. We just watch television differently now. We're not watching it obviously live and in real time for the most part. Older audiences still are to some degree, and of course we're still watching live sporting events. We're still watching certain live events. As they're actually happening, unfurling on television. But for the most part, yeah, we're watching time-shifted programming, or we're not watching programming at all. We're, scrolling through social media, like you mentioned, or we're watching clips on YouTube. It's definitely a bifurcated industry like we've never seen before.
Do you think programmers at places like Netflix and Apple TV are looking at these late night comedians and these interview type programs? Do you think that they'll pick it up? Stephen Colbert is even more popular than ever now. So do you think that he'll become a streaming show?
I think there's a possibility. I think there's also a possibility that Colbert goes on his own and maybe does something by himself on YouTube or on one of these services. Maybe he does a podcast that also doubles as a show on YouTube, which is Conan O'Brien has done very well with his podcast Empire. And all of those shows are also streamed video. So in some ways, we're still watching talk shows. They're just now podcasts on YouTube. It's a little bit harder so far. The streaming services, they've tried to do talk shows. They haven't really found a successful model for them yet. Most recently, Netflix did one with John Mulaney, a show that I really enjoyed, was critically acclaimed, but I don't think got a large percentage of viewers. It's just a different environment. There isn't that same sort of urgency watching streaming, and I think that's to the detriment of these very topical late night shows.
And there's so many streaming services. I mean, I get fatigued of how many I have and keeping track of them and whether I'm going to add this one or add that one. I can't be the only one who feels that way.
Yeah, no, and I think part of it too is it's much easier to cancel these services. So what we're finding is people are constantly subscribing and then canceling and then resubscribing again. And in some ways that's not a good thing for the ecosystem as well for these companies where they call it churn in the industry, and there is so much churn now that there isn't that guaranteed money that there once was for these companies back in the cable era. So that's also part of the problem.
Especially if they offer the first 3 months for free, because then you just sit there and binge everything, and then you don't stick with them.
Right. So in some ways, you can still beat the system, and that's sort of why all of these streamers have now gone to advertising models. And you notice that even Netflix now has commercials because, if you can't beat them, join them. And at some point, they realize that, well, if people are constantly canceling this service, then we need to find other revenue streams. And commercials, advertising, still one great way to get, dollars in their pockets.
Going back to late night just for a minute, to avoid cancellation or the wrath of the current administration calling them out or anything like that, do you think that TV producers for late night shows are trying to stay away from certain topics? Would that behoove them too?
I hope not. First of all, I think these shows have a natural voice, and it would be a shame to see them suddenly muzzle their voices. I haven't seen an example of that yet, at least with the shows that are much more politically driven. Shows like Jimmy Kimmel Live, which granted Jimmy Kimmel's been off for the summer, but Seth Meyers and then of course Colbert are still on the air, and he'll be on the air until May. I haven't seen themselves tone themselves down yet, so that's good news. But we'll see.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the future of television with Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV at Variety Magazine. There's been a lot of talk about the downfall of legacy media for years. It's been years and years we've been talking about it ever since streaming took off. Why are ABC, CBS, and NBC still around?
Well, broadcast, I think, has that natural advantage in that they're seen on, over the air airwaves. So there's still a percentage of people who still watch television, broadcast television. So the networks were always the biggest game in town. So, they have all the sports rights. And that's probably the biggest answer to your question is, there's still a lot of live sports on these networks, particularly NFL, NBA, some Major League Baseball. So that's really driving a lot of these networks. News is still, live news. All of these networks still have major news organizations. That's still a big deal. And of course, even local, these networks are all connected through affiliates that have local news outlets. And we've seen the importance of local news over and over again. So that's really made a difference, I think, in why broadcast is still vibrant and why cable is actually the industry that has really fallen apart and has seen a quick demise.
We'll talk about cable in just a second, but I wanted to bring up, you know, I mentioned ABC, CBS, and NBC, but I'd be remiss not to mention PBS. So the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been defunded. They're closing up shop. PBS will still be around. But what do you make of a big change like that? No more Corporation for Public Broadcasting. What does that mean for legacy media to you?
I mean, it's really stunning, and in particular, it's a blow to public media, and very, very concerning there, and particularly in local markets and smaller markets that depend much more on that funding from CPB that will no longer potentially operate. I think, you know, you'll continue to see PBS and NPR stations in larger markets like mine in Los Angeles, continue to operate just because they are big operations. But I'm concerned about rural areas. I'm concerned about small towns where perhaps the NPR or PBS station is the only local media. Those stations are going to struggle to survive, and that's a huge concern.
Well, talking about cable, because you mentioned cable, you know, aside from the networks, there's been shakeups on cable channels. HGTV canceled several shows. Fox Sports, known as FS1, canceled some shows too. And both networks are releasing popular hosts. Do you think we're going to see some of these longstanding cable channels go dark?
Yeah, you're already starting to see some of those cable channels go away, or they turn into what we call zombie channels, which is those channels still exist, but at this point they're airing pretty much all reruns, either old movies or episodes of past shows, and marathoning those shows and not really investing at all in original programming. And you've seen that really happen to even some of the big networks that we remember from the past, like MTV TBS, TNT. Some of those networks have survived a bit with some live sports, but they've really gone away from original programming because they've seen their viewership plummet, and there just isn't much revenue out there anymore for these cable networks as people cut the cord and move on to streaming. So yeah, you're going to continue to see more cable networks either go away or pretty much become shells of what they once were.
And we've seen a boom in massively acclaimed shorter series shows like Succession, Severance. Do you see an era where we're going to have just more and more of these 8 to 10 episode television shows that they're made at like a major motion picture quality, though?
Yeah, and that's been another big revolution in television, in that traditionally shows were 22 episode seasons, and back in the broadcast era that was the norm. And we've really seen a quick shift in the streaming area, and also we call it the prestige TV era, because these shows are so expensive to produce that at most they can do around 10 episodes. These days probably they do 8, and they're bringing in huge A-list Hollywood talent. Most of that talent demand more than $1 million an episode, so they really can't do much more than 8 to 10 episodes, and you've seen that become the norm, and that'll continue to be the norm.
Will network TV start maybe doing 8 to 10 episodes instead of 22?
It's not financially viable necessarily for them. They still have a schedule to fill. They still are very much in a linear world where they need to fill these nighttime blocks. And so they need shows that will last more episodes, 22 episodes. And those shows still do very well, by the way. NCIS, Law and Order, 911, all of those kind of procedural dramas that still have huge fan bases that go 22 episodes a season are also what's fueling the networks in prime time. So luckily that'll continue. And if anything, we're starting to see the streamers actually emulate that broadcast model a little bit. You're seeing success with shows that are a few more episodes. The Pitt on HBO Max this year, which was a medical drama created by one of the original creators of ER, went for 15 episodes, did quite well, is on track to potentially win the Emmy for best drama. So you may see more of that. And actually the streamers start to build up their libraries a little bit more with more episodes.
Yeah. What do you make of the Emmy Awards? Do they reflect the changes happening in television? Because most of the nominations went to non-traditional networks. They went to programs on streaming services. Do the Emmy Awards matter?
Yeah, interestingly enough, the streamers, because they depend a lot more on really holding on to subscribers and giving them, some sort of value added proposition to holding on to those subscriptions. They depend on awards as much as anything to remind people that, you should hold on to Netflix or HBO Max, because we have prestige shows that you want to see. We have award-winning shows, and they've leaned in much more to the awards than the broadcast networks ever did. So in a strange way, the Emmys became more relevant as premium cable like HBO came on the scene, and then the streamers came on the scene too.
Yeah, so you might as well, if The Pitt wins the Emmy, you might as well subscribe to Max so that you can see it, right?
Exactly. It's a good reminder that there's some good shows there.
Well, before I let you go, you're the executive editor of TV at Variety Magazine, so I have to ask, what television shows are you enjoying right now? What should I be watching?
Well, like I just mentioned, The Pitt actually was a stunning television, and really enjoyed those first 15 episodes. And then if you want something a little off kilter, but really interesting too, The Rehearsal, which also was on HBO Max with Nathan Fielder, is definitely an acquired taste, not for every listener, but really interesting for those of you interested in a bizarre comedy, but also in aviation. So those were two shows that I really enjoyed in recent months. And then The Return of King of the Hill on Hulu. For those of you who enjoyed King of the Hill the first round, it is back, and it is actually better than it was in its original run. So I would say definitely go check that out too.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Michael Schneider, the executive editor of TV for Variety Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how streaming services are changing the way we watch television. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Linear TV refers to the traditional way of watching television. Since the rise of cable in the 1980s, traditional viewing habits have undergone rapid changes. These include the conversion from analog to digital, multicast channels, and streaming services. With the Emmys being dominated by streaming shows this year, is there still a spot for cable networks? Joining me now is Robert Thompson, professor of media studies at Syracuse University. Welcome to All Sides, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you make of the cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert by CBS and Paramount? What do you think that says about the changing network TV landscape?
Well, first of all, I think when they said we did it for purely financial reasons, I think they were right. And part of those financial reasons were we really, really, really wanted that Skydance deal to go through for purely financial reasons. So I think it was both to throw an important bit of lubricant into the system to get that passed, which it did, and also the idea that, in fact, this was a really expensive genre, which, let's face it, CBS was already getting out of when James Corden elected not to continue in his Late Late Show. They didn't replace him. They put that game comedy show on, which they also didn't replace. It's going to be reruns of some comedy thing in that slot. So CBS was moving out of late night. They'd gotten halfway out of it already. But I don't think they would have probably this at this point have gotten rid of Colbert, who is the number one person in late night and who does have value besides just the number of ad dollars that come in. Yes, they're losing money in that respect, but they put guests on that promote other things and all of that. So I'm not sure it would have happened then. What I think is interesting, though, and you're right, linear TV is a model that's been so changed, and not just streaming, it was changed by cable. Even the VCR changed linear TV, which we can talk about. But oddly enough, late night seems to be more adaptable to the era of TikTok than an awful lot of other kinds of programs. The idea of watching an hour-long drama is something that fewer and fewer of my 20-year-old students are doing. They're watching things oftentimes on their phones, and they're watching little, you know, bursts of 30 seconds, a minute, whatever. Late night is actually pretty adaptable to that. When YouTube and the viral videos, remember that in the beginning of the century when that started happening, we started seeing all those viral videos before streaming really kicks in. Some of the earliest big viral videos were things like Lazy Sunday, Dick in a Box, those things, which were from Saturday Night Live, a late night show. You could simply excise them and repurpose them. Most people, I think, are watching late night now in that repurposed way. Very few people are watching it when it's on linear TV style. They're seeing it chopped up. In that respect, if I were a clever network executive, I would think, okay, so much of our linear programming is really going to be on the chopping block with all these changes. But maybe late night TV is a place where we can really adapt this to the era of streaming and TikTok and all of that kind of stuff.
So if you were Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon right now, would you lean really heavily into TikTok?
I think they're already. And Corden was doing that. What was that carpool karaoke? Mm-hmm. That was designed as a thing to chop up and put onto things. So I think they are already doing that. I'm not sure that the network executives have the I'm not sure they're smart enough to actually take this old genre. And let's face it, it's old. Late night television is, if you count The Tonight Show as the beginning, and it was actually going before that, is what, 71 years old. That started in 1954. And by the way, you watch Fallon do The Tonight Show like tonight, and you compare it to The Tonight Show in 1954, and it's different. It's in color now, but it's alarmingly similar, or not alarmingly, it's surprisingly similar.
Same
and
format, yeah.
Compared to what Carson started doing in the, 64 or whatever, it's very, very similar to that in structure, in style, and in lots of other ways.
So in the past, shows like Breaking Bad or Lost, they felt like cultural events, and everyone at the office gathered, you know, in the break room or around the water cooler to talk about it. Does that still happen in today's TV climate?
For one thing, very few offices have water coolers anymore. I think it's delightful that we describe that kind of programming is water cooler programming, because we're using an old office furnishing to describe a very old thing. But, you know, it still does. When Euphoria came out, I suppose a Succession was one of these things, not to the extent that it did in the network era before cable. I mean, when something happened on network television, everybody was either watching it or hearing about it. There was a show, it starred George C. Scott before he won the Oscar for Patton, and Cicely Tyson, first Black cast member as a star in a dramatic show. It's called East Side, West Side, 1964, I think it played. It got canceled after a single season with 22 million viewers. 22 million now would put you the number one show of the week, unless the Super Bowl had been on that week. I mean, 22 million is a huge number. So, no, we don't get that like we used to back then. But neither was Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad was discovered not so much on AMC where it started, and it was probably playing to, I don't know, what, like 2 or 3 million people. And then it moved to Netflix, and everybody kind of got caught up with it. And then they had the big final season when you had all these people watching. But by the standards of the numbers of people that were watching MASH, or All in the Family, or for that matter, The Cosby Show, or for that matter, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, right into the new century, you know, they are much more fragmented audiences for obvious reasons. When there were only three pieces of the pie to choose, everybody ate one of those three pieces. That's broken up into not an infinity number of pieces, but as close to infinity as I can conceive. I used to watch stuff because it was all that was on, and what was on the other stations I liked less. A kid today who's growing up in a household lucky enough with a few to have a few subscriptions never has to watch anything that they don't want to watch because they've got all these choices.
Yeah. Anytime we're in a hotel room, I don't bother hooking up any of my like Netflix subscriptions or anything. And I make my kids watch TV, just TV. And when the commercials come on, they're always like, what's going on? Why?
No, you're so right. I have seen kids totally. What is this? What's happening? The show I was watching isn't on now. Did we push the wrong button? And you know, it is fun. We talk about it, and we all know streaming has changed. I mean, with all this choice, but I think we forget the revolutions that took place before this. I mean, it used to be you watch what was on when it was on. I used to, as a kid, love those Christmas specials, Rudolph and Frosty and whatever. You had to put it in your calendar because if you missed it.
You missed it for a whole year. Yeah.
Until next Christmas.
Yeah.
The VCR, I still think, might have been the biggest revolution of them all, because for the first time, you could put television shows on your shelf like books. I remember as a kid hearing, you've never seen Citizen Kane? It's the greatest movie. How can you have never seen? I wanted to see Citizen Kane. I heard all this good. There was no place to see it. You couldn't go to the library and check it out. Maybe if you lived on a college campus or whatever, they'd have a film, you know, history night. But you had to wait till that stuff played. The VCR changed that and really started things like binge viewing. It was a pain. You had to learn to set the timer, and it took up a lot of space. But that moment when we could control when we watch stuff was revolution number one. Revolution number two, of course, was cable, where we went from having three or four choices in a middle-sized city to having first 25 and then 100 and all of that. So the writing was already on the wall. The era where we were all feeding from the same cultural trough, where Walter Cronkite, with no sense of irony, could end his nightly news broadcast saying, and that's the way it is. When Elvis played or the Beatles played, everybody watched it. When Lucy had her baby, those days were already gone by the time streaming kicked in. And streaming just finished off. If cable broke the culture into 100 pieces, streaming broke it into a million little pieces.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of television with Robert Thompson, professor of media studies at Syracuse University. When you mention the VCR, I immediately think of I accidentally taped over a season finale of ER that my mom had taped because she was working that night. And I will never live it down that I taped over it. And my kids would never have to feel that drama.
Right. Okay, first off, tell your mom to call me because I still have my VHS tape of that finale. It will be with Chicago commercials, not Columbus commercials, but close enough. Because that is, yeah, you're right. No, and not everything is available, but an awful lot of stuff is. But, you know, it is different. When in my history of TV class, I show everything as it aired with the ads and all that kind of stuff. And when you discover Cheers, a 1980s show, and simply, you know, binge it on a streaming service, it is a totally different experience than if you watch that show as it was, you know, as we watched it, with the ads and the promos. You get a sense of what the other shows that were on. We miss something in by taping over that stuff.
We're seeing a wide diversity when it comes to streaming TV. You know, the popular shows, comic book spinoffs, comedies like Ted Lasso, there's Star Wars spinoffs. They're all getting major accolades. But it seems like, does the TV industry even know what to make now? Because there's so much and so many different things.
They are. I mean, in the end, if you really want to make a ton of money, you make an old-fashioned three-camera sitcom. Two and a Half Men Big Bang Theory, Young Sheldon have made wheelbarrows full of cash since you and I started this conversation 9 minutes ago or whenever it was. These old school kinds of things are still appealing to enormous audiences. If I'm looking, and I've got a list in front of me of the top 20 streamed programs of 2025 up until now, so the first half of 2025. These are old linear network shows. Number two, Grey's Anatomy. Number three, NCIS. Number seven, Big Bang Theory. Around about 10, Law and Order. Gunsmoke is number 18. Gunsmoke was on the CBS television network from 1955 to 1975. It's been off the air for whatever 2025 minus 1975 years is. That's 50, right? Yeah.
Still holds up. Oh, man.
it's the 18th highest streaming series of 2025. I bring that all up because you ask a very good question. What do these executives, do they know what to make? You get a lot more buzz when you make a Succession or a Severance or an Atlanta or a whatever. And those shows are so much better. Yes, I grew up at a time when we were all watching the same thing at the same time. But what were we watching? Shows about talking horses and flying nuns. That was really what the shows were. There's so much better TV available now, but it is to a much smaller slice. You could never have played any of that great stuff on network television because you could get 10 million people to watch it. You could never get 30 million people to watch it. So the question is, do we make these zeitgeist shows that everybody is talking about, or do we make stuff that's going to maximize the audience and then presumably our income if we're audience-based? With streaming services that aren't fully advertising-based, they can do that stuff because they need to have a lot of buzzworthy things to make sure people don't cancel their subscriptions. If you're a place that's selling advertising, you kind of need to have, you get to charge more if you have more people. One of the reasons there are so many procedural shows, which seem so fusty and old-fashioned, is that they get big, big numbers. Now, unfortunately, a lot of them are older. CBS, is, I think the average age is like 67, which means me as an old guy born in 1959, I can't legitimately watch Blue Bloods, if it were still on, for like another year and be part of the actual CBS demographic.
Well, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, is there something you're watching right now that's really wowed you, something you've watched recently that you want to recommend to our audience, besides Gunsmoke, I guess?
It's interesting that you asked that because, you know, the last 20 years, there were all of these shows that were so exciting that, you know, Atlanta, Insecure, Breaking Bad, these things. And we seem to be at a point where there may be fewer of those. I know this is it's become a cliche, but The Studio on Apple Plus, I know everybody says it, and I know it got, 23 Emmy nominations, but that is worth taking a look at. I mean, I think of the last maybe 18 months or so, that's the show that I was most excited about. Adolescence, I think, is an interesting show as well. The ones that you get excited about are not the ones, though, that are, you know, the top 20 list of what people are streaming.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Robert Thompson, professor of media studies at Syracuse University. Thanks for joining us today.
That was fun. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the culture of television with David Van Cooley, TV critic with Fresh Air with Terry Gross. This is When All Sides Continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. From the very inception of television, it has been a cultural reflection on how we live. From The Simpsons creating an audience for primetime animation, to Friends glamorizing life in the modern city, to Lost reflecting Americans' desire for story-rich TV dramas. With the fracturing of cable and the birth of social media, does television have the same clout it once did? And how reflective is TV of this new age of media consumption? Joining us now is David Banculli, TV critic and guest host with Fresh Air with Terry Gross and professor of television studies at Rowan University. Thanks for joining us on All Sides, David.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. And I saw that Bob Thompson just left. You've got... I'm throwing myself into this, but you've got good guests on this topic today.
I love the guests on this topic today, and we're so happy to have you. When you think about the current television landscape in 2025, what stands out the most to you? Is it streaming? Is it the cancellation of Stephen Colbert's show, or is it something else?
Well, there's all those different issues in terms of, and I guess it's the same thing. It's what's happening technologically that the media is or are different. I mean, I see what's happening with broadcast going to streaming as something as inevitable as radio going to television. It's sort of the same thing. It's not even just television broadcast making room for cable, but it's sort of broadcast TV saying, like broadcast radio once did in the late 40s, that the future is over here. We're going to put our money and our talent over here, and we're gonna just make everything go that way. And what's interesting with streaming is that the audience was ahead of the broadcasters this time, by already preferring, no, I want to watch what I want to watch, when I want to watch it, at a pace I want to watch. And it is changing everything. One of the things it's changing is that we're not talking about the same stuff anymore. We're not seeing the stuff at the same time. That over the course of your program, Amy, you were going to mention something that I haven't seen. And I've been a professional TV critic for longer than I should admit on the record.
Well, as much as you say, you know, video killed the radio star, radio, we're still here. Here we're on the radio. You're on the radio.
Oh, yes.
From time to time.
I'm radio too. Radio adapts. Television will still exist. I'm not saying, but radio as in the 40s, everybody sat around the radio to listen to Jack Benny. In the 50s, everybody sat around the TV to watch Jack Benny. And you know, you thought, okay, radio is going to be this wonderful new medium that is going to provide an opera channel and a jazz channel and, you know, this. And it's like most people who had enough money to own a radio station went for the money, went for the popular stuff. So bless public radio, which has, you are well aware, less money than it ever did.
Less money than it did a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But it will survive and it will thrive. But broadcast TV, the only things I watch on it these days with regularity are 60 Minutes and, oddly enough, now Stephen Colbert. And both of them have been mistreated terribly by Paramount. So they have that in common.
What do you think is the biggest influence on how we decide what to watch? How do we pick what to watch on TV? Because it used to be you just, whatever was on, you had ABC, NBC, CBS, whatever was on at 8 o'clock, you picked one of the three. But how do you think people pick what they watch now?
I think, and I don't think this is necessarily wise, I think the best thing is social media. The same way a lot of people get their news is by what other people tell them or send to them. And so
My whole thing is, I don't know if you're a fan of Turner Classic Movies, but I am, because it not only presents movies restored, unedited, in full form, but it curates. It says, this is worth watching, and we'll have introductions. We'll have hosts to tell you why you should still watch Casablanca in 2025. There's no TV equivalent of that. So people are left to either get recommendations from friends who can say, oh, you have to watch Squid Game. I really thought it was surprising. And then all of a sudden you're watching a South Korean action show. Or you just go to whatever app you've got, whatever streaming service, and you go down the menu until you fall asleep. You don't even pick anything. It's like, well, that's enough. That's all I needed to do.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of television with David Van Cooley, TV critic and guest host with Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and a professor at Rowan University. With the cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, do you see that type of structure, that late night talk show structure, moving to another service like streaming? Or is that an older era of television?
Well, it's both. I see it moving, because what Paramount did, you know, if they want to cancel Stephen Colbert because it's purely financial reasons, as Paramount says, but speaking as a critic and as a human being and as somebody who looks at things, it's like, no, this was a reason because he kept yapping at the heels of the president, whose administration and FCC gets to decide whether or not Paramount gets to make a big business deal. And of course, they did. So, but to say we don't need the franchise anymore, we're going to take Late Show, which David Letterman started when he left another franchise, didn't get the Tonight Show after Late Night. And that means that what most people I know do today is to either somebody sends them, or they look on a news show, or they just look on their own daily feed and they get excerpts from the monologues or the show the night before. They don't stay up and watch that show. I am watching full hours of Stephen Colbert for the first time in probably, you know, more than 10 years. And
you're watching it now because he has popped
yes,
up in the
now
news
I'm,
and
now I
you're intrigued.
I need to react to something in real time in terms of news. Because I've already done one story on that. So now he's back in the radar, which is Paramount, both good and bad. They've already got their merger and so their price. So the value that they're building with the Colbert's program, The Late Show, is going to build and build and build as we get closer to the cancellation date. But then the show's not continuing. And the time slot is probably going to revert to local stations to make even more money showing movies and whatever they've got. And so they're not going to benefit from this. Stephen Colbert is going to benefit from this. And I see comics right now all over television, all over radio, in concert, as being one of the only two paths right now of real resistance to what is happening. The other one are grassroots people who are just meeting in places all over the country at town halls, at Tesla dealers, wherever they're going with signs to say, this isn't right, this isn't right. Comics are not going to let it go. Comics are going to treat Colbert as a hero and Marshall next to him and try and outdo him and get some attention of their own. This is going to be a very interesting 9 months, I think, is what's left.
Now, in addition to late night television, network news channels, they are struggling. What do you think will happen in the next 10 years to this idea of network news channels?
I don't know. I guessed the future correctly when I wrote a book in the 90s, in 1992. Mm-hmm. I predicted streaming and Netflix and all of that stuff. And I'm really proud of that paragraph. And
you predicted the internet. Oh my goodness.
not the internet, but the idea that you would subscribe to a streaming service that would allow you to get whatever TV you wanted, when you wanted, and you would pay for it and do that, which wasn't a thing then. But my son says, if you were so smart, why didn't you invest? So there are limits to my intelligence. But right now, even, 5 to 10 years from now, I am loath to predict. I mean, a couple of things seem safe. The networks are moving to streaming platforms. The networks are trying to push more live programming on streaming platforms so that Netflix, you get a late night show that runs once a week with John Mulaney. And they try that for a while. They've done a couple of things where sporting events, which used to be always free on broadcast TV, there's a couple of them that now you pay for, including the NFL, including, so it's all going to head that way. That's where the audience is. That's where the money is. So the democratic nature of broadcasting is going to change. Sesame Street, public television, the idea that you can help kids no matter what, just as long as they have an antenna that they can grab the signal from. Now you've either got to subscribe to HBO in order to get it, or maybe it won't exist at all in a while. And that's very frightening. But that's what's happening to more television. But I'm not sure what form it's going to take in 8 to 10 years. I'm most concerned about the continued fragmentation of the audience. Like right now, if I ask you, and so I'm going to, what's your favorite show, either that's on right now or that has been on recently, that you just devoured and loved?
Shrinking.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, Shrinking
Apple
is
TV.
What? Apple TV.
Yep.
Apple TV Plus,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of seasons in.
Yes, I'm so excited for season 3. I wish they would go faster.
All right. It's a really good show, but because of how much TV I have to watch to try to almost keep up, I've only seen the first episodes of season 2 that they sent when they sent those out for pre-review. I love the show too, but I haven't had the time to see the others. So you've seen more of Shrinking than I have. And that's just, it's just one example. And at least Shrinking I've seen. You could have said something that, I'm not even close to. And it didn't used to be that way. We would all talk about Twin Peaks and Dallas and MASH, and the whole country was in on it. And I don't know if I've tried to not be an old person and try to say, well, the aggregate audience, it's slowly built up. It's the same sort of thing. And people are hearing about the bear. And so they're slowly coming to it and they're coming to it. But I don't think it's the same thing.
We're running short on time, but I wanted to talk about, you traced the evolution of classic TV in a book called Platinum Age of Television, from I Love Lucy to The Walking Dead, How TV Became Terrific.
Now we're out of time.
No, we still have 3 minutes. So if that was the platinum age of television, how would you classify the age of television we're in right now?
Oh, we're still in platinum. Big platinum to me is 1990, post 1999. We're in this new age post The Sopranos, where showrunners are more in charge. We're more. Producers and networks and streamers are taking chance, trying to stand out. So they're giving chances to really good people and good shows. As we're speaking, one of the reviews I just recorded but hasn't run on Fresh Air yet is of Alien Earth, which starts soon. And it's Noah Hawley, the same guy who adapted Fargo for television and Legion, which is a Marvel superhero I'd never heard about. And he does great work with these adaptations. Well, Alien Earth is wonderful. And I don't know that it could have even been made 10 years ago. So we're still in the platinum age, but the age is going to change. And I don't know what the next name is. I didn't even get that far in science. What's higher than platinum? Records, they don't give anything higher than platinum.
There's a double platinum.
Oh, double platinum. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, are you writing another book about the post-1999 age of television?
I'm writing a book right now about the visual artistry of the Beatles and trying to make an argument that what they did or approved or inspired in terms of movies and TV appearances and videos and magazine spreads and everything else, lithographs, is as important and very similar to what they did musically. So that's what I'm playing with.
All right. Well, we have a minute left. So you watch a lot of TV. You are a TV critic. What's a program that you've enjoyed recently that you want to tell people about?
I've already mentioned Alien Earth. The other one that's starting a new season, I think it starts today. If this is out there, I don't know if we're recording for later or whether this is live.
Oh, you're live, man.
Okay. Well, hi, everybody. I hope everybody's good. Then right now on Netflix, you can watch the first half of the second season of Wednesday, which is the Addams Family carry off. And the first series 3 years ago proved to be one of the most successful English language shows ever done on Netflix. So they threw a lot of money into it, a lot of guest stars. It's great this season.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to David Banculli, TV critic and guest host with Fresh Air and professor of television studies at Rowan University. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Amy. I had a blast. Sorry I went on too long. Professors do that.
You've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.